that's really interesting and valuable. We've never seen anything like that. You should figure out a way to deliver that business architecture map to us, to your customers.
It's like light bulbs. Light bulbs are going off in my head.
And we're back. Back with Rick Merrifield. Back with more about motion here on ArtCast. Hey, I'm your host, Ron Jacobs. Delighted to bring you this information once again. You know, I tried something new with this. Because he refers so often in the audio to slides that we were using on this webcast, I posted the slides for one, but if you'd like to see a video version of this where the slides are synchronized to the audio, there's a link for that as well. And that one includes the whole thing in one very long video. Okay, it's about, I don't know, 60 megabytes or something. But hey, you got broadband? Go download it. All right? Now, some folks are saying, hey, you know, I don't know what this motion thing is. I had never heard of it before. But we're about to go much louder with this in a very public way. So let's pick up the conversation again here on ArtCast.
I take you now live to Microsoft Studios where ArtCast is already in progress.
So, you know, it was kind of funny. Last night I was watching television. I saw this very nice feeling commercial come on about the pharmaceutical industry. And they said, what if you were running this large pharmaceutical manufacturer? What would you do? And they had these, you know, people saying nice altruistic things like, I'd try to change the world. I'd try to make life better. And I was thinking, no, you'd try to make money. That was because that's what businesses try to do. If you don't make money, you're out of business. So really, well, you have to produce business value, right? And so what is business value?
Well, business value is an interesting term that's been used a lot in the last couple years and has become sort of as squishy in terms of hard to grab a hold of for a lot of people as business architecture. And so this is a picture that we've got from a woman named Renee Moburn, with permission from her, that she built for Starbucks. And it's a really good illustration for us that, again, the notion of this what you do and the capabilities that describe an organization are actually all nearly identical for any company in the same industry. So what they're doing is the same. It's how they do it that really differentiates from a brand perspective and from a profitability perspective. And this picture of Renee's on the bottom has words that are similar to what we would describe as a capability, but not identical. And so she's got quality, speed, convenience, fashion, selection, ambience, price, location, and service expertise mapped against emphasis. So this is taking Starbucks compared to the rest of the industry. And this, when she built this, the rest of the industry, to use some North American examples, would be Denny's and Tim Hortons, for example. Somebody else that sells a cup of coffee. And so they have all of these, to use our word, capabilities, but clearly Starbucks emphasizes things radically differently from the rest of the industry. So particularly looking at the middle of the slide, fashion selection and ambience, Denny's and Tim Hortons couldn't care less about those things. Starbucks emphasizes them a lot, which contributes directly to their brand, but it also has dramatic implications in terms of where they spend money. They spend a lot of money on fashion selection and ambience. Similarly, as you continue to go to the right, you see price. And from an emphasis perspective, in many ways, but not in every way, Starbucks doesn't care what they charge for their product, which is a nice
look. I noticed that. Every time I go there, I can't believe I spend this much.
You know, which is great for them for generating operational capital, whereas for Denny's and Tim Hortons, it's just a different idea. And so their idea is that they want to make it affordable. A low price point is important to them. And so where you put your emphasis, and so whether it's a people thing or a process thing or a technology thing, that is really what drives out where your profitability and your brand lie. And until you get to this more stable view that exposes and allows you to see in a more holistic view, where is that value coming from? And a lot of people have a high-level view today about what their business drivers are and what their key performance indicators are, and that's still valid. But it's difficult for them to get really granular 6 and 7 levels down in decomposition of the capability map, because they've been using process maps that, because of their inherent instability and their short half-life, you can't have this holistic view because it gets so out of date so quickly. And now we're finding with the capability mapping, we can get this more stable view that helps organizations get to this level of exposure to say, what should we be emphasizing? Where are our profits coming from and not coming from? What does associate with our brand? And also, as the view also attaches to these external views of customers and partners, suppliers and regulatory bodies, you can also see how different pressures from those different organizations will drive and inform organizational behavior. So if fewer customers are coming to your organization, that's information that should drive some other performance in your organization. If you've got so many suppliers complaining about price, I mean, I'm just making up some examples, but a very clear visibility into what drives performance and what levers are and are not related. There's actually a really good example that we have. Again, I'll use an example that we were not directly related to. That's been widely reported. Toshiba had a laptop repair problem for their consumer, the typical consumer that would go and buy a laptop. It was taking a very long period of time for them to physically repair the laptop. I think it was more than 2 weeks. And the person at Toshiba took a look at it and said, you know, 2 weeks is a really unreasonable period of time. Let's break this thing down and look at what's going on. And it turned out that, to use our language, that the laptop repair function was not a series of laptop capabilities with a logistics component where they had to transport the laptop back and forth, that the amount of time it took transporting the laptop to the repair technicians, they were only spending an hour or two actually actively repairing the laptop, and all of the rest of this two-week period was logistics. And they said, well, it's really then a logistics set of capabilities with a laptop repair component. And so they said, if this is really more of a logistics function than a laptop repair component, we're not in the logistics business, and logistics are not core to our business, but we do want to have this laptop repair, you know, perform at a certain level, and we'd like to have high customer satisfaction. So they ended up outsourcing the function to UPS completely. And UPS hired all of the Toshiba laptop repair technicians, and UPS managed to get this turnaround time, because they're so good at logistics, to an average turnaround time, I think, of less than 3 days. So going from 2+ weeks to under 3 days, because of this realization that they could move the work across the corporate boundary to a third-party logistics provider once they realized that the capability was one that, in large part, they didn't care about, but it had to be there and had to perform for the business, really highlighted for them where they needed to put their emphasis versus what they could outsource to somebody else.
That's an amazing way to think about this, because Every business, you know, wants to do things well, but you can't do everything at the high emphasis level, right? And so you have to pick and choose your battles well, and understanding the capabilities is really crucial to that. So really, the business has to define where they're going to differentiate.
Right. Exactly. So the discussion of which capabilities differentiate, which is partly a brand function as well as from a profitability function, which capabilities contribute most to performance. The discussion of cutting costs versus driving best practices is one that I often get exposed to, and my answer is that, you know, it depends on the function. So cutting costs is really valuable if it's a function like payroll, where by our definition it's a capability you don't care about. So as long as you don't degrade performance or compliance, it's really valuable to cut that cost. Investing to the level of best practice can make sense in other areas, but even if something best practice, a lot of people think of it as the what they want everything to function in their business as a best practice. But if you have something that is your source of differentiation, and then you overlay that with an industry best practice, you're actually going to destroy value, because your differentiator is probably better than the industry best practice. And so another example that we'll use, to use another North American example, is comparing Sam's Club and Costco, two companies that sell a lot of high-volume retail goods to the consumer markets. Most people, they are in the same industry, and so their capability maps, to use our language, are virtually identical. The big difference is that Sam's Club makes their money selling their retail products, and Costco doesn't make much money selling their products, which kind of sounds strange, until you realize that Costco makes most of their profits from their membership dues. And so Costco's, the decision for them, if you applied retail standard retail industry best practices to Costco, you would be at risk of destroying value, because they're so focused on driving profits from membership dues. And so that may even sound like a very narrow focus for Costco, but the whole idea for Costco is you go into their stores and they want you to have a great customer experience. They want you to feel good. They're giving you free food and you're feeling good about the experience, so you will renew your membership. Sam's Club doesn't think that way. They don't care whether you buy the product or I buy the product. They just want somebody to buy their product so they sell enough of it to get the volume they want to make the money, the profit on their margins. And so having really clear visibility into where that value is can better inform the decision of, should I just think about it like cutting cost? Is it more valuable to invest at the level of best practice? Or is this something that really is a source of differentiation where best practice wouldn't even be enough, that I need to really cultivate this function and really optimize, whether it's because of people or process or technology that makes it the differentiator? It could be any one or all of those three things. Really be clear about that.
You know, and I think it would be crucial for everybody, at least at some level in the organization, to understand where you're going to emphasize the value, right? Because otherwise people are doing things that in the long run are over-investing in an area where you don't really care that much about. Well, we have a question that sort of relates to this, and somebody was asking, well, how do you identify and select these categories where you're going to do your value prioritization?
That's a really good question. And the next couple of slides speak to that, but I will answer it now, that in a lot of cases, in most cases, a business will have some assertions about where the value comes from and where the differentiation comes from. Whether they define that rigorously or not will vary. Let's just take one extreme. If you don't measure it very carefully, you're not very rigorous, you have an idea of where the value comes from, but you're not sure. Having a model like this that allows you to test your assertions is really valuable. So you think this is where value comes from, so you spend some time focusing on that, capture some of this capability information, capture some of the metrics. You may learn that it in fact does not directly correlate to performance as much as you thought. So having sort of checked that and say, I was wrong, I'm going to move on to the next thing so that I can then expose where the performance is really coming from, having this stable view, you can get to a clearer understanding of where the real value is coming from. The more optimistic example is you have an assertion of where the value is coming from and you validate it so that you can clear away the encumbrances that prevent it from performing better and saying, adding technology or changing the people or changing the process will optimize the performance of this. Giving them something that they can build on as a view will allow them to get to a more measured, more structured way of capturing value. And so this model allows you to either already be very rigorous about measuring value or not rigorous at all, and having an entry point so that you can further optimize from there. Which does get to the last point on this slide. How do you pick a project? If you buy into this philosophically, where do I start? Because if you have an 1100 capability map, that's a really big thing to start with. And given your point earlier, Ron, that the business, you know, here's sort of SOA as this really big bang thing, the same thing can be true of business capability mapping. You say, well, 1100 capabilities, that sounds like an 18-month project with some really high-priced consulting company. That's not what I want. So we say, no, you don't need that. You can start with one of our industry templates, pick a project that's already on your list, whether it's on the business side of the house or on the IT side of the house. So business examples that we've done are, I'm trying to decide if I should outsource this thing. How complicated or messy or valuable is it for me to outsource this? I'm looking across multiple lines of business in my enterprise. They seem to be doing the same thing across all lines of business, but they use different language or they use different process, and I can't figure out if I can use the same technology to support those seemingly different things. And how do I get more measured about that? We've done a bunch of examples of that. And then in the context of technology, we actually are just finishing up an internal project at Microsoft where one of our IT departments is migrating to a new technology. It's not SOA related at all, but reaching out to the business side of the house to say, what are your requirements? So as we get to this future state architecture, how can we ensure that we're aligned with what your business goals are as we migrate away from some of this outdated technology or yesterday's technology? And so that then leads into some questions about something I haven't talked at all about yet. Other methodologies that people use and methods, Six Sigma, Business Process Reengineering, and the Zachman model, we've actually spent time with the inventors of or well-known practitioners of those other methods and have gotten verbal and written endorsement from – well, we've gotten verbal endorsement from John Zachman. We've worked very closely with the Business Process Reengineering inventors, and the original Master Black Belt from Six Sigma has articulated how this business capability mapping complements those other methods in some very specific ways. And I can talk to that as we get into the more details about what Motion does.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier you had some Excel stuff you wanted to show. So this would be a good point to – so go ahead and go to that next sharing slide, so you'll bring up Excel on your machine.
Yep.
Okay, and you can press, by the way, for the viewers, you can press F5 if you want to see this in a full screen view.
Okay, so this this view, which is, I won't say intentionally not very sexy, has a list of, and this is a map of capabilities from a standard template map, starting with our level one is the creating products and services show, and this shows in Excel what that decomposition looks like just purely from a labeling perspective of the capability. And so what I'm going to do here is, and I'll fill in some of the content to make it a little bit more dramatic, is you see the two columns on the left refer to the border rating and the interior rating. So if I rate 1 to 5, how, in this case, the border rating is how it is performing today. And I can, these columns can mean anything you want them to mean, but I'm going to say the border rating means right now that this is how it is performing today. Interior rating is how I want it to be performing. If I can build a heat map to show that comparison for my business architecture, that's going to allow me to at least focus my attention. So as this outline mapper builds what it's building, where there's a difference between the border color, and this is in Excel, by the way, the border color is different from the interior color. That's telling me that it's, whether I've decided that subjectively or objectively, it's telling me that how I want it to perform is different from how I think it's performing. And so it's a really good starting point for a conversation to say, I should probably focus my attention, for the capabilities that I think I care about, I should probably focus some attention on spending time about whether I should, the value of getting the interior color to be the same as the exterior color. And so when we show this to organizations today, they'll often get very excited and say, okay, that's very visual. I get what that's telling me. If I want to go beyond just those two columns of being very subjective about how it's performing and how I want it to perform, what else do you have? And so the other thing that we have here is a so this is a slightly different lens on the same list of capabilities. So it's we have the up here is the overall. Can everybody see my cursor moving? This is the top level view of the business architecture. So this orange, the create products and services, is what's getting blown out down here in detail. What we have going to the right now, there are what we call 20 questions. 20 questions about several specific areas where we'll interview. And this is, again, where a technology person can credibly go in and ask these questions of a business person when you're saying, how much business value is contributed by this capability, high, medium, or low? Does the capability differentiate the competition from the company from competition, yes or no? Does an increase in the performance of this capability directly improve the performance of its parent capability? And so on and so forth, asking questions in very clearly defined terms. How mature is it? How attached is it to regulatory and governance information, interconnectedness information? How is it performing? How is it attached to process views, specific metric information? Very clear questions. And then even in this case, we've got some technology information around the way the current technology that's supporting and what's anticipated to be supporting that from the perspective of technology, and then aggregating the answers to those questions. So here's the summary from a scoring perspective of business value, maturity, regulatory, interconnected, performance, process. And then over to the right, there's a very specific set of values here where the business person and or the IT person can assign weightings from a value perspective for each of the value, maturity, interconnectedness, current performance information. And so then you can use this content either in aggregate or by itself. So I can take the regulation values and answers and build a heat map against that. If I could build a heat map comparing, so again, we've got those two columns of border and interior rating. I could have my border rating being a regulatory and compliance piece of information, the interior rating being a performance thing, and informing all kinds of questions and discussions with the business to say, here's what you've told me about your business and what you know about performance and maturity and interconnectedness to drive and inform our discussions about where we should spend time improving the business and where there's an opportunity potentially to apply technology to improve whatever column we want to focus on. And we've had really good feedback that this heat mapping set of tools, as simple and subjective as it can be initially, can be really effective and useful at driving a better conversation about where to focus energy from a technology perspective.
Okay, so that is totally amazing. I didn't know you could make little graphs like that with Excel. That is very cool. But, you know, Excel is a pretty amazing tool.
Yeah, I have to tell you. And to be honest, I'd spent a lot of time talking about building these heat maps in a customer setting before we were able to do them as effectively as this. And this customer said, you know what? This is so powerful, I'm actually going to build this for you. So he hired a consultant and built that heat mapping tool for me and gave that to me and said, you can use this now because this is such a better way of articulating how quickly you can get value from this than what we've seen from the tool that you've got today. And so I have to tip my hat to that customer for giving that to us.
Wow, that's great. Okay, so you've taken all of this stuff that we've been talking about, this learning and the heat maps and whatnot, and packaged it into a program. I don't know if that's the right word to describe it, this thing called motion.
Yep.
So what is motion?
So motion, having been very clear or having gone in a lot of detail about how we define business architecture, motion is a methodology that we created that uses that business architecture model to help customers solve a specific problem. And so back to the point earlier that, you know, these big, huge 1,000 capability map pictures can make it difficult to say, well, where do I start? Well, motion is the where I start if they haven't already figured out where they want to apply the business architecture technique. Motion delivers them a business architecture map with a lot of the property information populated. And we also deliver a project recommendation. So we get very specific about what the, you know, as I said earlier, questions, should I outsource this thing, or I look across business units to try and find consolidation opportunities, or even just IT reaching out to the business for a specific set of requirements, provide a recommendation about what the next step should be. So whether they should make a change to people or process or technology in the context of cost and benefit and risk, and also make some observations about whether it would make sense as a next step to use one of these other methodologies that has been popular, so Zachman and business process reengineering, being very clear about the relationship of the information we've exposed to how they could apply one of these other methodologies if that's a relevant or appropriate next step. There are a bunch of forms of it now. The typical motion project is 8 weeks in 4 different phases, so each phase is about 2 weeks. We will typically sell it fixed fee by phase. We'll have usually 2 full-time consultants and a quality assurance person. We can sell it since we do it fixed fee by phase. It's become increasingly common for customers to buy just phase one to start as a consulting project. And we now have Motion Lite, which is a 2-day workshop that is a not-for-fee workshop delivered by our developer platform and evangelism group, enterprise partner group, and others to help introduce the concepts of business architecture as we define it to customers and apply it to the project portfolio of some business decision makers so they can not only see what business architecture is, but they get some deliverables that are inherently valuable to them in terms of how they prioritize projects. It's absolutely not strategy consulting. It's business consulting where we, when it's paid consulting, we'll go in and we'll ask these questions of business people to help them expose their business architecture. We're not going to go in and say, you need to do this to optimize your business because that's what the rest of the industry is doing. We're just exposing information about their business and helping them come to a conclusion about what the right next step is based on this new lens that we've provided into their business. Proven and mature in that we've been doing these projects for over 2 years now. On a paid consulting basis, we have a lot of proof points in a variety of industries that there's a bunch of value out of this. The tools are available. We also make the methodology available. So if you want to do this as a paid consulting engagement with us, that's fine, and we've got resources that have been doing this now for some time. If you don't want to pay for the consulting, we can make the methodology and the tools available to you on a not-for-fee basis. Given that the objective of this is to help customers do a better job of describing more objectively what their needs are, this helps us, it helps other vendors as well, but it helps us once we see this content from the customer, our field organizations and services and sales can now have a much easier time articulating the value of our products and services with this additional content.
So, and one of the listeners commented, man, I want to attend one of those Motion Lite workshops. You know, that sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, that'd be the kind of thing that you could go to this, you get a more in-depth this overview, and you get the tools and that you could go and do this yourself then.
That's right. Yeah, so we certainly all the heat mapping things I showed in Excel are provided, and there are 5 very specific deliverables that we use in Motion Lite that are taken out of the full 4-phase motion projects, which are made up of 27 unique deliverables, which we'll get into in the next slide.
Okay, so this is sort of gives you that breakdown of the 4 phases that you talked about earlier, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So this is as far as we'll go with motion, and we were very deliberate in saying these projects can't be more than 8 weeks, and that was I'd said from the beginning that even if we can't completely resolve the problem in 8 weeks, if we're spending more than 8 weeks trying to resolve it, we're probably going down the wrong path. And so that was part of that decision. And we said, okay, phase one, we'll spend a couple of iterations with the industry-specific capability map with the business decision maker, rationalize that a bit, and get down to at least three levels of decomposition to make sure it is in fact specific to their business and capture some of the key properties in terms of who owns it and who's the customer of it and how it's measured and so forth. And that will then further inform, as we capture that heat map Excel file information as well, answer the 20 questions to really answer the question of which project should we pick and what's the value of that project based on what we know now. And so you see that stop sign. We have a go-no-go decision on moving forward into phase two to say, are we very clear about the anticipated business value of the project? And are we clear that we believe motion is the right path to take to expose information about what to do about this particular problem space? In phase two, we go into a lot of the more conventional project work where we'll collect process maps and IT architecture diagrams and organizational charts, and we'll use a lot of that information to learn about extract the capabilities from those views as we get more and more detail. And we'll try to get down for the specific problem area. Having already built a level three map for the entire business, phase two is where we'll go really deep for the specific problem area that we're focusing on. And then we'll do, at the end of the second part of phase two, is what we call go in, go up, go out, and go down, which Jim Champy, who is one of the creators of business process reengineering, highlighted as one of the really big differences in this methodology from other methodologies, where in most other methodologies, people hear about what the problem is, again, whether it's in business or IT, and then just break that sort of back to the process map we looked at the beginning of the discussion, within the confines of that 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, look for the resolution of the problem, and then really break those pieces down into smaller pieces to find out what part of that process is broken. What we do with motion is to say, okay, we go in, we collect information about what the problem is, and then instead of going down and decomposing, we go up and force context setting between where the project sits and the department it's in, as well as the rest of the organization, to understand the relationship of this project space to the performance of the business and some of the other interactions that go on in that business, to see where some of those performance levers might be at a higher level in the composition of the business architecture. We then go out to understand how this problem space does or does not interact with external bodies of customers and partners and suppliers and regulatory bodies, to understand where it sits on the business boundary, and if in fact there are some external organizations that are participating in this problem space that may end up playing a role in the resolution of the problem. At the end of phase two, we have a first off-ramp discussion, and that's what that green rectangle represents, where we ask the question of the project financial analyst, who's a customer resource. There's a significant amount of involvement from the customer on these projects, and there's a project financial analyst who's responsible for saying, after we've done this analysis through phase two, we are still clear that there's enough value to proceed with this project. We're clear about what the value add's going to be, and we should proceed with this. If that's no longer the case, if we've learned something or exposed something in our analysis in phase two where we don't think that it's either going to be more risky than we thought or more costly than we thought or not as valuable as we thought, then we should off-ramp the project and stop it and go do something else. The other reason, more common reason for taking an off-ramp that we've found in doing motion projects, is that as you get into this more detailed analysis, you can often uncover a much bigger problem than the one you started with. That happened to us with a bank in the northeastern part of the United States last year, where we were asked to look across several lines of business in the organization where they seemed to be doing the same thing. And they said, well, we're spending millions of dollars on this function. We bet that if you look across those organizations for commonalities in the functions, you can probably cut some costs out of that. So we'd like you to do one of your projects on that. So we went in and did that. And while we were doing our analysis, uncovered significant Sarbanes-Oxley and SEC violations that were a much bigger priority for the business than cutting a couple million dollars out of the spend in this particular area. And so that was another good reason to take an off-ramp. And so having a very structured way to stop the project when you have a good reason to stop it was why we explicitly called out these off-ramps. So that's phase two. Phase three we get in is where we really build that layer view that we looked at earlier, where we attach the people and process and technology views to the business architecture view. And we have some really interesting 3D rendering views now that are supported by Visio through our SQL Server-based tool that really help illustrate those layers and those dependencies that really help expose what things can and cannot be changed in the direction of improving the performance of the specific area we're looking at. And then in phase three, we have another off-ramp discussion. And then at phase four, we get into the project wrap-up where we formalize our recommendation. We'll typically have somewhere between 8 and 12 alternative recommendations, say, here's what we picked, but here are the other things we didn't pick and why, so that if the recipient of the recommendation has questions about it or wants us to drill down in some additional areas to potentially come up with a different recommendation, they can see why we made our decisions and whether or not they agree with them. The other thing that helps us do is that 6 or 12 months down the line, when somebody asks a question, they can say, well, why in the world did you decide X? And they can produce this deliverable and say, here's why we decided X, and here's why we didn't pick Y and Z and other options. So from sort of building a business case, if you will, for a decision, it's a really powerful set of deliverables for somebody to justify a decision that they're making around a particular problem space. And that's what we do in our four phases.
Okay, so this sounds fascinating, and the really fascinating thing is you've been doing this, it's been working, and I love hearing about the cases where it's really made a big difference. What about this case study here?
This case study, and we now have approval to talk about the actual name of the company from both organizations. We've had a lot of difficulty in getting approval to talk about case studies, given that our job is to go and help solve some nasty problems for customers. A lot of customers don't like to talk about those nasty problems that we help them solve. This is a case from the mid part of the United States with a great big logistics company called C.H. Robinson, where in April of last year, they came to us and they'd heard one of the motion presentations from one of our executives. And they said, you know what? It was actually their CIO that engaged us. He said, you know, I really want to move ahead with a services-oriented architecture. I totally get the value of it. I still understand that there's some technology issues I haven't totally resolved in terms of definition of the granularity or the size of the web service and how big or small I should make them and the implications around maintenance of the web service, but also how to inform some of the reuse decisions. And because my business units, and there are five business units in my company, don't talk to each other very well, it's difficult for me either to articulate the business value to them of a service-oriented architecture, but also for me to actually make the business case, because I'm not seeing as much leverage from this model as I wanted to from a financial benefit perspective. And so part of the problem was that this is a company that's made up of five distinct business units. They're doing pretty much the same thing in terms of providing transportation for a variety of industries. Sometimes they're doing it with boats, sometimes with railroad cars, sometimes with trucks, sometimes with partial truckloads. Each of the five different lines of business had evolved at different stages in the company's history, and partly because of that, they had evolved completely different sets of language for talking about what it is that they do. And that prevented them from talking to each other about either finding ways to leverage technology or best practices or any of that kind of conversation. And they knew that they had that problem, but they had never found a way to resolve that communication problem. And so the CIO became the sponsor of the project and asked for senior executive level buy-in across these five business units in a week and a half through executive interviews, asking questions very much like the 20 questions we looked at in Excel. We were able to break through this communication barrier and expose that when they thought going into the project there would be about a 15% overlap in the work they were doing, we exposed that it was actually closer to 60% commonality of the work they were doing across these lines of business. And so now the business themselves, completely independent of technology, they have a common language. They're able to use this business architecture model as a way to expose areas for business improvement. And the CIO now has a clear window into where the greatest opportunity is for rolling out a services-oriented architecture. And having seen how much overlap there is across the business units, he's anticipating an over 20% reduction in capital expenditure out of his budget overall as a result of this, what was a 7-week project with C.H. Robinson. And so now Motion and the business architecture tools that we have been rolled out completely across all five business units on the business side of the house, and IT is using it as the standard for capturing business requirements for all projects.
That's amazing. I can imagine how this would happen, because I think that's part of the biggest obstacle, like you said, is bridging that communication gap between what people call things and how they describe their process. And you know, I've talked to a lot of people who felt the same way, that they intuitively sense that there's real value behind the principles of SOA, but they've had difficulty in articulating how that's going to benefit the business.
Right.
And, you know, maybe in the 90s you might have got away with, here, let's do a buzz project right. because we got the cash flow. But it ain't happening anymore, right? People are demanding something more. And you're arguing here that really moving to service-oriented architecture is not a simple thing.
It's not. And I think part of the challenge is that, I mean, the thing that Motion is really good at is helping the IT side of the house articulate the business value of a services-oriented architecture, first and foremost by not using the term SOA with business, but finding a word service that's closer to what the business is familiar with and giving them some business architecture deliverables that are inherently valuable and new to the business. But there are some additional technology challenges. And I spoke earlier about some of the decisions from C.H. Robinson about granularity and reuse decisions. But there are also, and I'm not going to get into the specifics of this particular slide, but making decisions in each of these areas, as you look at the rows and columns of extensibility and supportability and repeatability and usability, prioritizing and understanding those decisions are really key to a successful SOA decision deployment from a technology perspective, and helping organizations figure out those technology decisions and prioritization decisions is something that we are seeing that in a lot of cases IT can make some of those decisions with things that are quote unquote behind the curtain from the business. So server consolidation stuff that can be accomplished that doesn't directly touch an end business user. So they can learn some of these decisions about extensibility and reusability and supportability, so that once they've sort of learned how to make some decisions and maintenance and so forth, they've learned more about where they need to focus their energies to be successful, then they can begin to reach out and have the discussion with the business where they've had some success with web services already, but then begin to go into the business and say, we understand your service level expectations and we're going to support them. And the business actually doesn't ever have to know or care about the fact that they're using SOA. As long as IT is supporting their needs or exceeding their expectations, that's all the business cares about in most cases, and that's all they should care about.
Yeah, I mean, you don't. It's just a headache you don't want to have, right? If you just say, take care of it, I don't care how you get it done.
Right.
But there are issues, both from the IT side and the business side, about how do we move towards service orientation.
Right. And so as I said, there clearly are in a lot of organizations some IT-specific issues in terms of basic – they get the model. But in terms of taking the next step, in terms of understanding how to avoid rework and not learn too many painful lessons as they move forward, making decisions about granularity and reuse, understanding from an ROI perspective, purely from an IT perspective, what that model looks like. And so – having the ability, and in our case, there's an appendix to the Motion methodology called Translating Capabilities to Services. Having that conversation about from a business ROI perspective as well as from a technology ROI, return on investment perspective, how to think about that and how to prioritize that in the rollout decision. And then migrating away from legacy applications. A lot of both people that I meet with from IT and from the business do see this as sort of a big bang model, that it's an all or nothing, bet the farm, this is what we're going to do. And it's not really – it's not that. And having a clear migration strategy both from a risk management perspective is helpful. There are some questions that we see come up about – and this becomes more of a political conversation, but there are people who own – the applic like Siebel or SAP, and they have this very big group in the company that's in charge of Siebel or SAP. And as you begin to migrate to a different architectural model, that can begin to whittle away some of the responsibility set of the person who owns SAP. And so we've seen some of those discussions go on that they're trying to protect their political turf. And so I'm not in the business of resolving those political discussions, but those are very real things that happen, and having some better understanding of how to resolve that and define a go-forward path for that are areas where we're getting requests for help, and the more case study information that we're able to provide is helping organizations make some of those decisions in IT. On the business side of the house, it's much, much clearer in that there's no appetite for the big projects. A lot of people got burned in the 90s with the big projects when the IT people knew a lot more about technology than they did, which is still true. But the business people have gotten more savvy about technology, and they're not going to sign up for something that's a big bang, big risk project that can be too disruptive or too damaging. They don't hear – if people talk about services-oriented architecture, business people just don't hear value to them. They hear cost. They hear wires and pliers. They don't hear anything that relates to things that touches them. And because IT is still not good at talking to the business, this dialogue isn't really making any headway until you get to something that what we've been finding is that this capability language does allow arm the IT organization with a set of questions and artifacts that allows for a bridging of this gap that's beneficial to both business people and IT people.
Well, I think when you move to thinking about the business in terms of the capability, then you can get away from these big empire discussions and whose political turf you're on and forget all of that.
Right.
We're talking about a capability has real value, it has cost, and we need to create a solid boundary around that thing so we can think about a service level expectation.
That's exactly right. And this, again, echoing the cube picture we looked at earlier, having that ability to isolate and put clear boundaries around that block of work that is the capability. Whether you're talking to a business person about changing their process or whether you're talking to an application area owner about changing the use of a specific application, it does come down to the specific business value in very objective and measurable terms, so you can begin to get away from some of those more political conversations.
Well, and, you know, you have to measure the value of these projects. And you just can't throw money at the problem and not have a measurement of the value.
Right. So capability mapping and motion both together help. Service level expectation provides a really clear way that is understandable to both business people and IT people for getting to those metrics. The capability is a more stable view than what most people define as a process. Defining where the business value is now easier and more objective. And then defining the role of IT in the business performance is now clearer and more objective. So the return on investment and value add discussions become clearer and more clearly exposed.
Okay. So really, I mean, this has been a fascinating discussion from a guy who has, like, you know, little understanding of business architecture. You know, it would be nice. And I remember hearing people say, you know, those business people, they just don't know what they want. You know, we start this project, they keep changing their mind every other day. And many, many projects failed because they weren't able to capture this kind of understanding of the business. And I remember reading somewhere that the number one cause of these kind of failures was not a, you know, pure technology failure because, oh, we didn't understand how to solve the problem. It's that they solved the wrong problem.
Right. Well, that's, you know, and putting a little bit of a Microsoft slant on it, you know, if a customer comes to us and says, go install SQL Server, we're going to go and install SQL Server, but we have no idea what problem they're trying to solve with that. So it may turn out that whoever picked SQL Server made the wrong decision. But if SQL Server ends up being the wrong answer, we will often get blamed for the failure of this thing, even though we were not involved in the discussion of what problem it was solving. And so if we can be a little bit or a lot further upstream in understanding what problem's being solved and whether or not SQL Server is in fact the right answer to that solution, not only improves our chances of success, but improves the organization's chances of success in terms of aligning, figuring out, you know, does technology play any role in solving this problem is one question. But once the decision is that yes, technology should improve the performance of this part of the business, saying whether it's SQL Server or some other product or service or whatever, becomes a much clearer and more objective conversation for us and for everybody.
Well, if a customer then, you know, wants to get involved in doing motion or, you know, going to these motion light things, where do they go?
So there's a fair amount of information that's publicly available. Increasingly, there will be information out on MSDN. I think the motion light document is now on MSDN. I'll have to check on that. It will be at least in the next week if it's not now. There's a lot of information that sending an email to motion@microsoft.com will come to my team and that we can handle one-off requests. We do have, in terms of what's new, and I had some discussions as we got this set up, hearing that this is an audience that's near and dear to Microsoft, we will be able to make the latest version of our SQL Server tool, which goes out into beta next week, and the heat mapping tool will make available to this audience, given who the audience is and how valuable it is to Microsoft, on a not-for-fee basis with usual beta licensing terms. It's all in beta. So in the sense of using it at your own risk, and we're not going to support it, but you can use it and see it. And if you have questions, we'd love to hear what those questions are. And we can also, whether or not Motion Light is available on MSDN, I can make that available as well. And the best way to get to that, if it's not on MSDN, is just to send an email to motion@microsoft.com.
Okay, so are we envisioning that this would be something that maybe partners might use, might take our motion tools and take this thing into their customers and use them as well?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the expectation. We've been slow is probably the right word in rolling it out to partners. We're now just getting to version 4 of the documentation and the deliverables. We wanted it to be more mature and more tested before we just sort of opened it up and said partners can go use it. Because we knew that, well, partly because it was so different for us as an organization, but also because what we think the value to customers and to partners. So for, in a lot of cases, the value that a lot of the partners add is the best practice content, the business expertise, the strategy consulting piece that we're just, that's not our business. Adding that to these stable, common business architecture maps that we have, really clear, simple message in terms of the value add of partners. And so I think we'll start to see, as we get to our FY07, which of course starts in July, we'll start to see a more clearly defined, delineated partner strategy as we learn a little bit from the version 4 that's just coming out now, and we get the feedback from the beta tool when this gets more baked. Because for the last 2 years, it has been a very – in fact, it was just me until September with two partners that we've been working with. And we now have a team. It's still fewer than 100 people, but it's been growing very fast in terms of field delivery and my own team. And so I think it probably will be the middle of the calendar year timeframe when we have a more defined message for the role of partners.
Okay.
From a programmatic perspective.
Yeah. So one of our listeners is asking, you know, you mentioned early on that the public sector is a little different in terms of that overall business architecture map. How can Motion assist with the public sector architecture requirements? Does it help them?
Yeah. So, and that's a good question. So we've done some work with public sector, and the most glaring area in sort of our template maps is we've got a lot of templates in retail and commercial banking and manufacturing and healthcare, and all of those, for instance, will have a big set of capabilities around demand generation marketing. Well, marketing, it does not play as prominent a role in public sector as it does in private sector. And so there's a little bit the best analogy I have is that it's like squeezing a balloon. You just have a different shape of the capability map in public sector, but you have the same value add in terms of saying what are the capabilities, how are they being measured, understanding where the boundary – we call a business boundary of the public sector organization is relative to its other constituents. All of those same concepts apply, and so all of the information in the schema still applies. It's just going to have a different shape than a lot of our template maps for private sector industry. And so, yes, the answer is absolutely. We see similar value in public sector. It's just a different kind of a conversation because the shapes of the maps is so different. And I don't currently have a template map that I can make accessible to people today.
Okay. Well, Rick, thank you so much. This has been a really great and very informative conversation. Thanks for being on ArtCast today.
Thanks for inviting me. Okay.
Rick Merrifield, ladies and gentlemen, Rick Merrifield.
Wow, isn't that really interesting? You know, after I hear stuff like this, I think, I wouldn't do that. That sounds like a fun job, you know, to kind of go through and help people to plot out the business and look for opportunities for cost savings, and thinking about how we could build IT systems that would help to eliminate redundancies in the business. Because, hey, the bottom line is, the business writes the checks that pays the bills that keeps you employed, right? And so that's why we have to do things that support the business. We have to do things that make sense. And hopefully, this made sense to you. I hope you enjoyed it, and thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on ArtCast.